So when it came time to get pregnant, my wife, she was on top of it. She wasn't on top of it. But she led the charge, right? She got all these devices, and she'd take him in the bathroom. I don't know what she was. She was, like, doing science. I don't know what was going on. But she would come out, and she'd be like, all right, Trey, I think I found it, the three-day fertility window, but I can't be sure. So to be sure, we should be active 5 days before, three, and then the five after, just to be sure. Y'all, if you told little shelter Trey that one day he'd get to do it for 2 weeks straight with a woman as beautiful as my wife, I would have been so excited. Y'all, it was a living nightmare. I was like a quarter horse roped up in the bedroom. I swear during one of these 2 week stints, I literally had COVID. I was like, should I go quarantine? She was like, put on a mask and lie down. I was just limping in the bedroom like, can we watch Netflix tonight? Please, I'll watch it. I'll watch Virgin River. I'll watch it. She's like, there's no virgins on this river tonight. You better get your paddle out.
Sex, marriage, and motherhood. The holy trinity of things we're supposed to have figured out, but mostly just Google in incognito mode. Add in trying to get pregnant, and it can feel like a business transaction, as Trey Kennedy so brilliantly articulates in his comedy special called Grow Up. So let's talk about it. No judgment, no sugarcoating, just real, honest conversation about what's happening in modern marriages and how to keep things alive. Because if no one else is going to say it, I will. Trying to maintain a sex life while you're exhausted and your house smells faintly of chicken nuggets and dog hair? Not exactly the stuff of romance novels.
Google Calendar invites my partner and I send to each other to plan intimacy in our relationship in a way that makes it fun, exciting, and definitely not boring.
You know, the sex can happen anytime during the day when the kids are a little bit preoccupied, and we just kind of sneak that in.
I have two small children, and sleep is the golden currency in our house.
I have absolutely no interest in having sex with my husband at all. While I may not need it, I know he needs it, and it's getting very challenging for me because I'm just kind of in this, please don't touch me, I don't want to be touched, and I want to have sex, but I don't.
Also, if you're listening to this with kids in the car, maybe switch to Encanto or whatever Disney is serving these days. We're going there today. Motherhood is history's greatest untold story. It's built empires, fueled revolutions, and pushed the boundaries of science. And yet, because it happens in quiet rooms, behind closed doors, it's been left out of the grand narrative. But make no mistake, motherhood is not just tenderness. It's raw, unrelenting, a force that tears you apart and remakes you over and over again. It's blood, bone, love, and sheer will. This isn't a story about sacrifice. It's a story about power, about what it means to become a mother and what it means to never stop becoming. This is Bloodline and Backbone.
One day I'm going home. I feel it deep inside of my soul. I ain't got a lot of silver and gold. I got what cannot be sold. I'm gonna see it in. So take what you wanna take, but you can't take it to the grave. You know everything is fading away. I might not have it today, but I'm a city.
Okay, are married couples having less sex, more sex, or is everyone too tired to care? Let's ask our favorite sex expert. Sexperts? Whatever you want to call it. Let's ask all our burning questions about doing the deed.
So, sweetie, are modern married couples having less sex, more sex, or are they just too tired to even care at this point?
I would say in the work that we do together, and also as a biblical counselor, like what I'm hearing in session, I don't know if you remember this, sweetie, but our friends Shanti Feldhahn and Dr. Michael Seitzma wrote a book about this, The Secrets of Sex and Marriage, and they, you know, interviewed all these married couples, like hundreds of married couples, and one of the questions was, do you feel like you want less sex or more sex in your marriage? And they were assuming, they thought, well, with this trend of having less sex, that most would say, you know, a lot, at least one of them would say less sex. And surprisingly, both partners overwhelmingly, like a high percentage, said they want more sex.
There's so much pressure on couples right now. And I would say moms in particular, really. I mean, moms have, there's social media has invaded. There's a lot of good on social media. A lot of the ministry we do is on social media. And so there is so much good there. But then in the midst of all that goodness, there is this subtle, insidious temptation to fall into this comparison trap of thinking you got to keep up, you got to do all these things. And a real mom does X, Y, and Z. And there's all these different, like if you're not, you know, living on a prairie and churning your own butter and homeschooling your 14 kids, you're not a real mom. Or if you're not working
you're not a good
two
mom.
Jobs and
not just a real mom.
Doing the, yeah, it's like all these different competing definitions that nobody can live up to these standards that are out there.
I think that for a lot of us, we wait until the end of the day to make love. Like, you know, it's really important that when it comes to kind of our flow of when we are being intimate with each other, we need to look at that and say, like, well, what is the pattern that we're seeing?
Yeah.
And for a lot of couples, they wait till the end of the day. And that's when, you know, for men especially, their testosterone has plummeted. And so they're having to kind of, you know, will themselves to be in the mood. Although for most men, it's not as much of a venture as maybe it is for women. But for women too, you know, we're usually exhausted too at the end of the day. And then all of a sudden we're like, okay, well, here's the one time of day we can make love. But really, when couples really look at their schedule and they think about, well, when can we kind of, you know, schedule in sex, which doesn't sound very sexy, but really maybe consider a different time of day. Like maybe we meet on a lunch break and we actually have energy and we make love in the middle of the day where our hormones, you know, are better and in more of a place where our libido is going to be a little higher. Maybe we can do that. And like whenever we've talked to couples and encouraged them to do that, they're like, oh my gosh.
I've never considered
that. It's so much better.
Yeah, it's like, because if you're giving the worst of your energy, which is the end of the day for all of us, is usually the worst point of our day, the lowest point. Like you said, we have hormonal fluctuations throughout the day. We're dead. And it's like, if you're giving your leftover energy to something that should be a priority, then the priority is going to start feeling like leftovers. I think one of the ruts we can fall into in marriage is when sex starts to feel more transactional than as a place of connection, mutual connection. And what I mean by transactional is like when sex is given as like a reward for something or withheld as a punishment for something, or it's almost like, well, if you'll do these things, then, you know, you're going to get sex.
Or you're just literally checking the box.
Right. Checking the box. Yeah. Right. Like I've got to do this. It just is a chore. You know, it's on my list. I've got it, laundry, sex.
Right. It's
dishes,
just another thing.
Some, you know, and that's not going to be great for either spouse, really. I mean, what God's designed for sex is it's mutual pleasure, mutual connection, a time where you're experiencing this intimate oneness, mind, body, and soul. I mean, it's really such an important gift for marriage. And if we're removing the emotional aspect, even the spiritual aspect altogether, and it's just kind of this physical transactional thing where you can mentally check out and just kind of go through the motions and experience physical release, then you're not really experiencing sex the way that God intended. Mm-hmm. And it's not going to be this beautiful binding force in your marriage the way that God intended.
Usually we're going to have different libidos, but we need to connect sexually because it's a body, mind, spirit connection. And when we're not regularly having sex, we really have that. We feel that disconnect. And so it's important to kind of, you know, talk about it, get down to what's really going on, even in the postpartum, being tender with each other, but really doing our best to reengage in that way.
If you're a mom in 2025, chances are your sex life and marriage look different than they did before kids. Maybe it's better, maybe it's non-existent, but no matter what, one thing is clear. Marriage, sex, femininity, and masculinity are shifting, and we're feeling it. Here's what the data says. 54% of moms say they are having less sex than a year ago. Sexless marriages now make up between 25 and 50% of marriages. 75% of women report faking orgasms, and 70% of divorces are initiated by women. Perhaps this shift is aligned with our changing cultural attitudes about these hot button topics, because America's relationship with sex and marriage is changing faster than a kid swiping through TikTok. According to Gallup, we're way more chill about things that used to make grandma clutch her pearls. In the last 20 years, the number of people who say stuff like having a baby outside of marriage, sex before marriage, and even divorce is morally acceptable has jumped, sometimes between 20 or 30 percentage points. 79% of Americans now think divorce is fine. 73% are cool with sex between unmarried adults. Even polygamy. Yes, polygamy has crept up from a measly 7% approval to 20%. We're loosening the moral corset one lace at a time. But here's where it gets interesting. Just because people think something's fine doesn't mean they're doing more of it. Divorce? More acceptable than ever, but the actual divorce rate is dropping. On the flip side, all this moral flexibility does track with real-world changes in some areas, like the fact that about 40% of babies in the U.S. are now born to unmarried parents. And while no one's saying that relaxed attitudes are directly causing the decline in marriage or birth rates, you've got to wonder, when marriage stops being a social requirement for sex, babies, or even commitment, what's left to pull people down the aisle? Or to stay married, for that matter? Unsurprisingly, cultural attitudes toward adultery have not changed over the decades. Cheating is still unacceptable. Of course, this whole moral makeover didn't just pop up overnight. We've been here before, several times actually. The Industrial Revolution in the late 1800s shook things up as people left their small town communities for city life, where the rules got a little fuzzier. Then came the Roaring Twenties, when flappers, speakeasies, and jazz made it clear that the old guard's moral code was more of a polite suggestion. And let's not forget the 1960s, a wild cocktail of birth control, feminism, and a general middle finger to authority, when the sexual revolution cracked the whole system wide open and, quite frankly, brought us to where we are today. More on that later. So what we're seeing now? Just the next chapter in a long, messy story about how society keeps rewriting the rules on sex and marriage. And if history's any guide, we're probably not done yet. Every time the culture shifts, the moral compass gets a little recalibrated. What feels shocking now might be tomorrow's meh in our society. Which begs the question, how do we find our footing in all of this? Where can we stand firm as we navigate these increasingly choppy waters of sexuality for ourselves, our relationships, and our children? Happen in a vacuum, and neither does sex. Every late night argument, every risque text message, every time you roll your eyes at yet another article about keeping the spark alive, but then click to read out of curiosity, it's all part of something bigger. The world tells us our struggles with sex and marriage are personal, but they're also profoundly cultural. Maybe for you, it's sex feels like just another chore on my to-do list, or my marriage still revolves more around his pleasure than mine, or your sex drive is higher than your husband's, which is also incredibly common. These aren't just private frustrations, they're echoes of a much larger tale, one shaped by the sexual revolution, the rise of internet porn, and generations of shifting expectations around femininity, masculinity, and marriage, to just name a few. So let's zoom out, because what feels personal is often deeply, unavoidably cultural, and we're all swimming in it.
Today, the National Woman's Party lobbies for the 26th Amendment to guarantee women equal rights under the law. That amendment would make women people in a legal sense for the first time.
The unfairness and the ridiculousness of the whole situation of ever suggesting that a man should be superior to a woman. Brains are brains and they're genetically born. They're given to you at birth. And it doesn't matter whether you have the female body or a male body. Brains are there. Therefore, they should be paid accordingly.
The Women's Liberation Movement organized several groups to protest the Miss America pageant as a symbol of society's exploitation of women as sex objects.
We are a species of extremes. Our brains are hardwired for oversimplified black and white thinking, life or death, good or bad, provision or poison. This predilection for the binary served us for a long time. It kept us alive, kept humanity running, but it doesn't serve us so much now. Now this tendency shows itself in ways that leave us divided and lacking nuance. modern politics are a prime example. And when it comes to the sexual revolution, this binary thinking runs deep. Depending on who you ask, it was either the best thing that ever happened to women or the beginning of the end. Liberation or destruction, progress or disaster, nothing in between. So before we get into this next segment, I have no agenda other than to approach the history and reality of sexuality and femininity with the nuance and complexity it deserves. So let's talk about the sexual revolution.
These pills contain a natural substance that keeps the eggs in the ovary from getting ripe and being released. But the eggs are still very much alive. Whenever the couple decides it is time to have another baby, the woman simply stops taking the pill, and soon the next egg ripens and is released so that it can be fertilized.
Let's talk woman to woman. Nowadays, we're free to do so many things. Women have more alternatives, and Semacid is one of those alternatives. It's a safe, simple way to prevent pregnancy.
Free ourselves! Free ourselves! Free ourselves! Free ourselves! Free ourselves!
It really is a revolution.
The sexual revolution of the 1960s and 70s fundamentally reshaped Western culture's view on sex, marriage, and gender roles. In broad strokes, it was about dismantling centuries of control over women's bodies and choices. The birth control pill gave women unprecedented power over their fertility. No-fault divorce laws gave women a way out of marriages that weren't serving them. Women entered the workforce in record numbers. Culturally, sex became more about pleasure and less about procreation. And listen, all of this was huge. The ability to control when and if you have a child, that's just not a convenience. It's civilization shifting. But as with any revolution, there were unintended consequences, even from a strictly secular lens. Some of them were predictable, others not so much. The promise of sexual liberation didn't account for the fact that men and women experience sex differently, biologically, emotionally, and socially. It didn't predict that a culture where sex is abundant and easily accessible might not actually be a paradise for women. It didn't anticipate that a world with fewer social constraints on sex could leave women feeling less powerful, not more. Enter Louise Perry.
I think that the sexual revolution from the get-go had downsides for women. You know, not to say that anyone designed it, it's not a conspiracy. You know, it's a culmination of a lot of different historical accidents and individual behavior and whatever.
Louise Perry is a journalist and author of The Case Against the Sexual Revolution. And let me tell you, this book is a wrecking ball to some of our most cherished ideas about sex and freedom. She argues that the sexual revolution, while offering some undeniable benefits, ultimately created a world where women are more vulnerable, not less. Where the line between liberation and exploitation is razor thin. Where the cultural script tells women to embrace casual sex, but biology and psychology often leave them feeling disconnected and used.
The common narrative that you'll hear a lot nowadays is, I think, that people are starting to recognize, including feminists of all different strains, are starting to recognize that there are problems with the sexual culture. Recognizing, for instance, the fact that porn is really grim. A lot of young people are really unhappy, not having happy sexual relationships, all of this. I think that pretty much across the board, everyone agrees. What everyone disagrees on is the cause of it. And a common narrative that you'll hear is from feminists or from progressives is that the sexual revolution was a great idea and it was a way of counteracting centuries of oppressive patriarchal repression. And the problem is just that we haven't like fully implemented it. We need more freedom. Mm-hmm. We need to push that freedom lever again and again and again until everything comes right. And I think that was the error. I think actually freedom is not the preeminent value. I think it has to be balanced against other values.
Like what?
Like restraint.
Oh, we don't like that word in the 21st century, do we?
We don't, no. I mean, I guess the point that I'm coming at this that makes it particularly a feminist argument is I think that male restraint is the really important thing. Which no one wants to hear. The expectation now on women is that they will meet the male demand for casual sex because obviously the sociosexuality gap has to be bridged somehow. And if there aren't enough women who are outliers and really up for it, you know, there's a kind of, it's, you know, I say again, it's not a conspiracy. It's just a culture. It's a networking effect that the incentive structure has changed and it is now more in women's interests to imitate masculine sexuality and to have sex like a man and moreover to present that as being feminist. and as a form of empowerment, as a form of, you know, self-expression and all of this. The problem you've got is, one, the physical imbalance, the fact that women are suffering all of the costs of this, and two, is that psychological, like, deep down reluctance that a lot of women feel. Mostly no, yeah. And, you know, women are much more likely to say that they feel really miserable and depressed after casual sex, to feel used, you know, all of these kind of negative emotions coming out of these encounters. And this will sometimes be chalked up to, you know, particular men behaving badly, which obviously they do often, but will sort of be seen on an individual level, or will be ascribed to slut-shaming and say, well, the problem we've got is that we actually haven't sufficiently freed ourselves. Is that pressing the freedom lever again and again, right? Mm-hmm. The problem is we've still got these hang-ups about sex. We still haven't completely completed the sexual disenchantment process. Women are still, like, ashamed of their sexuality, ashamed of being seen as promiscuous, etc. That's why women are completely miserable. I don't think that's true.
Every 2 years, students at Yale experience a tradition on campus known as Sex Week, where they gather for an array of adult product demonstrations and presentations by pornographers and sex therapists. However, in 2010, one female attendee of a Sex Week event exposed a hidden motivation when she told the Yale Daily News this. She said, "Many of us have never failed at anything, and we don't want to start now." These young women are achievers. They want to be the best at whatever they do. And now they view sex as one more area to excel in. It's a fresh annex of performancism, a new way for women to have to excel. It's not just about connection, intimacy, or even their own pleasure. They want to be good at sex because it's one more accomplishment to add to the proverbial resume. Whether we like it or not, we are all living in the aftermath of a sexual revolution. And if we're going to talk honestly about marriage, about sex, about how men and women relate to one another, we have to look soberly at what brought us here and where we want to go. Because here's the thing, culture never moves in a straight line. Every revolution sparks a counter movement. And right now on TikTok and beyond, we're seeing women embrace a strikingly different version of femininity.
Number one rule as a trad wife, this is your duty as a wife. A man's home is his castle, so he should be treated as a king. He's working a stressful job, maybe working long hours, just so he can provide for you and the family. So he rightfully deserves peace.
People on this app act like this is the worst thing in the world. Stay at home, mom. My husband's at work providing for our family. I have some sourdough fermenting on the bench, a baby, an apron, a cute dress. I've, you know, had the corporate job. I have made a lot of money outside of the home with no kids. You know, live the boss babe lifestyle, and I hated it.
This morning I asked my toddlers what they wanted for breakfast, and they both said cereal. So cereal it was, and we got started right away. I made two types of cereal. The first one was chocolate chip cookie cereal. So I mixed some flour, peanut butter, maple syrup, milk, and chocolate, and formed that into a dough.
He is your king, and you are his queen. That is your duty.
The tradwife trend romanticizes 1950s-style homemaking, where women trade career ambition for domestic devotion, swearing by submission and sourdough starters. Meanwhile, other women are rejecting marriage altogether, leaning into self-sufficiency or fully embracing the hot girl sexual empowerment ethos. Here's an old clip of Cher that recently went viral.
Man is absolutely not a necessity. Did you mean that to sound mean and bitter?
Oh, not at all. I adore dessert. I love men. I think men are the coolest. But you don't really need them to live. My mom said to me, you know, sweetheart, one day you should settle down and marry a rich man. And I said, Mom, I am a rich man.
While women are busy debating what femininity should look like in the modern world, men are facing an identity crisis of their own. By almost every measure, education, mental health, career ambition, even basic life expectancy, men are struggling. And if we want to understand what's really going on in marriages and bedrooms and in the unspoken tension between men and women, we have to start here. Having a son is the best. Seriously, my son Joseph is in college now. He's part of a band, lives in a house with 10 people in Santa Barbara where there is cheetah print carpet covering the walls. It's a whole scene and I am so here for it. Joseph is smart, kind, a hard worker, and shockingly funny. So as a mom of a young boy who I can't say enough good things about, you can imagine my surprise at the recent man versus bear scenario that swept across the internet. Apparently, if you ask a woman whether she'd rather be alone in the woods with an unknown man or a bear, 7 out of 8 will pick the bear. And honestly, as a woman, I get it. This viral moment reveals that men as a group have a PR problem. And if you ask Richard J. Reeves, author of Boys and Men, it's not just perception. It's rooted in a deeper reality about our boys and men.
The overall picture is that on almost every measure, at almost every age, and in almost every advanced economy in the world, the girls are leaving the boys way behind, and the women leaving the men.
Men are falling behind, and not in the women are crushing it, go us way. It's more like, hey, why are all the guys still living in their mom's basements and quitting college at record rates kind of way? College enrollment is plummeting for men, 7 times the rate of decline compared to women. Depression and isolation among men are skyrocketing. 3 out of 4 deaths of despair, suicide, drugs, overdoses are all men. Testosterone levels dropping, sperm counts down 60% in just the last 2 decades. We've got young men struggling with erectile dysfunction in their 20s. Something's off. If you would have told our grandfathers that one day men in peak physical health would be too tired to have sex, they'd have spit out their black coffee and gone to chop some firewood just to reassert dominance over nature.
One of the real challenges here is that if there are men missing from certain crucial areas of our society and our economy, that makes it harder for other men and boys to flourish in those areas. We have an education system that has a dearth of male teachers. We have a labor market where the jobs that are growing fastest are ones where we have the fewest men. And in families, there's the growth in what you might call the dad deficit or fatherlessness. As men are struggling in each of those areas, what you'll see is it'll be harder for other men to follow in their footsteps. It's harder for boys to flourish if their fathers aren't engaged. It's harder for men to enter occupations where there aren't men. It's harder for boys to do well at school where there are no male teachers to be seen. And so there's a very real danger that unless we act quite soon, that we will set in train, something of a vicious cycle.
Men are struggling at the same time that society is telling women they don't need them. So we have a generation of guys absorbing the message that they're both dangerous and unnecessary. That's not exactly a confidence booster. And here's where it gets even trickier. If men used to be channeled into purpose, work, marriage, fatherhood, now they have an endless buffet of quick dopamine hits to replace those things. Video games, porn, OnlyFans, social media rabbit holes. There's no need to take risks or pursue real relationships when there's a simulation available 24/7. And honestly, that's killing both men and their relationships.
Today, 15% of young men say that they don't have a close friend. That was just 3% back in the 1990s. And so we're seeing a 5-fold increase in the number of men who have no close friends.
Not to sound like a conspiracy theorist, but if I wanted to neutralize an entire generation of men, making them unmotivated, overstimulated, and disconnected from reality would be a pretty solid plan. Add some isolation, internet connection, and a lifetime supply of energy drinks, and you're golden. But make no mistake, this isn't just a men problem. It's a relationship problem. It's a fatherhood problem. Women don't need men to be better because we're pining for some 1950s return to tradition. We need them to be better because strong, whole men make strong, whole families. And that benefits everyone. So if men are checked out and women are exhausted, where does that leave us in our marriages? Where does that leave sex? Here's a thought. Maybe the real revolution isn't in breaking more rules, pushing more limits, or quietly resenting our unmet needs. Maybe the real revolution is a relaxed woman, the satisfied woman, the woman unburdened by shame, unafraid to ask for what she wants, unapologetic about desire, not just for sex, but for a whole beautiful, sacred expression of intimacy in her marriage. What if it's about raising the bar? Healthy people ask for what they want. They don't tiptoe around it, hoping their partner will suddenly develop mind-reading abilities. So if you feel lost in your own desire, if sex feels like something you give rather than something you experience, maybe the first step isn't trying harder. Maybe it's getting quiet, getting curious, and asking. what do I actually want? And then talk about it. Ask your husband what he wants. Turn toward each other with honesty and hunger, because here's the truth. How we relate to sex ripples into everything. It's generative. When passion is thriving, you feel it in your confidence, your parenting, your work. It's energy, God-given and deeply spiritual. And yet so many mothers are running on fumes. The mental load, the invisible labor, the sheer exhaustion of being needed all day long, then suddenly being wanted at night. It's no wonder that so many women find themselves disconnected from their own bodies, their own pleasure. But here's what gets lost in the chaos. Motherhood and sexuality were never meant to be at odds. In fact, they're deeply intertwined. The same force that brings life into the world is the one that fuels intimacy, connection, and renewal. But somewhere along the way, we started seeing them as two separate identities, mother and lover, nurturer and seductress, when really they were always meant to exist together. There's a reason every major faith tradition treats sex as sacred. There's nothing casual about it, even when we try to make it so. In the Hebrew tradition, yada, to know, is used both for intimacy with God and for sexual union between a husband and wife. Adam knew Eve and she conceived. It's more than just a body meeting body equation. It's knowing and being known. See, our culture has spent so much energy trying to free us from sexual constraints. But what if the true freedom isn't in avoiding limits, but in embracing the right ones? What if real passion isn't in chasing novelty, but in committing to depth? Because at its core, sex is about union, the great longing of the human heart to be seen, to be fully known and fully accepted. It's why we crave connection, why we ache when we feel distant from the one we love. And it's why nothing bonds a marriage like deep, regular, connected sex, which, by the way, doesn't have to look like a slow motion movie montage with candlelight and perfectly tousled hair. Sometimes it looks like laughing in the dark because someone's foot just cramped mid-missionary. So if you're waiting for permission to want more, here it is. Create your own sexual revolution, not one dictated by culture or shame, but one rooted in wholeness. And if you don't know where to start, try this. Sit down with your partner, write down what turns you on, write down what shuts off your desire, swap lists, talk, laugh, get curious, and try not to judge him too hard when you find out one of his turn-ons is watching me parallel park perfectly. When we stop making sex another box to check and start seeing it as a language, one that speaks love, trust, and renewal, we don't just fix a problem. We unlock something holy. And maybe the most powerful thing you can do as a mother is to remember that you are also a woman, a whole, radiant, fully alive woman, not just for your marriage, not just for your kids, but for you. Next week, we're uncovering the hidden power of mothers, from their economic influence to their cultural and spiritual impact, and why the key to transforming communities starts with them. We'll see you then.
This has been Bloodline and Backbone, a production of Momco Media, created by Mandy Arioto. It was written by Emma Turnbull and Mandy Arioto. Produced by Jeremiah Shoemaker. Special thanks to Dave and Ashley Willis. Music composition and sound design by Sleepy Dog Creative. Our executive producer is Kelly Jo Smith. And our theme song is Glory by Zuri Alvarado. If this episode moved you, share it with someone who needs to hear it. And don't forget to follow the podcast so you never miss a new story. You can reach us at media@themom.co. We'll see you next time on Bloodline and Backbone.